It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, with milk prices at record lows, some farmers are asking if there's a better way to price milk. A Wisconsin dairy policy expert looks at some different alternatives. First, new details have emerged in the lawsuit filed by Milwaukee Bucks rookie Sterling Brown against the Milwaukee Police Department and the city. Brown was arrested earlier this year after illegally double parking in a handicapped spot at a Walgreens. Before he was arrested, he was tased. Originally, officers argued that Brown was combative and dangerous and that they acted out of fear for their safety. However, body cam footage released last month didn't seem to back up the officers' claims. Brown's lawsuit alleges that officers handling the case didn't provide him a Miranda warning and that one officer in particular made a series of racist posts on social media. Ashley Lutheran is the public safety reporter at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Ashley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you wrote a piece about new information that came out in this lawsuit filing that we hadn't known yet about this encounter between Sterling Brown and police officers. What kind of things did we learn there?
There were several new things that came out in the lawsuit filing. The lawsuit, first of all, alleges that one of the officers actually did pull out his gun during the encounter. But what's captured a lot of attention are these Facebook postings from one of the officers involved. They do appear to, at least on the surface, violate the department's standard operating procedure about social networking sites. And that gives guidance to officers about how they should conduct themselves while online.
And those included a joking reference to the encounter with Brown himself, is that right?
That's correct, and that would be posted just hours after the arrest.
And also other things posted, memes or reposting things that appear to be racist in regards to other basketball players in some cases.
Yes, that's how the lawsuit characterizes them, yes.
Mm-hmm. What don't we know? What kind of info has not been released so far by the police department?
Well, there's a lot we don't know. We are still waiting for our full response to the records request for all of the video, body camera, and dashboard camera, all of the reports of the incident itself, as well as all of the internal affairs reports. Now, today, it does appear, based off of some action and notice given by the Fire and Police Commission, that the internal investigation is not over. And we know that because today, Chief Morales was supposed to go before the board this evening and kind of explain the audit into the incident, his decision-making process about the discipline, and those sorts of matters in public session. That has been postponed because apparently the internal investigation or some sort of investigation is still ongoing and discipline is still on the table, apparently.
Have we heard anything about the possible discipline that could be imposed on officers here?
We have not heard anything. The Fire and Police Commission doesn't want to hear any of possible evidence before discipline is handed down because they're the ultimate arbiter. If an officer appeals disciplinary decisions, it goes before them. But right now, we don't know what sort of discipline could be being considered at this time.
Let's look at the lawsuit now. What is Sterling Brown claiming? What is he trying to accomplish in this lawsuit?
Well, Sterling Brown is claiming that he was wrongfully arrested. Officers used excessive force during this incident in January on the city's south side. He's specifically alleging the police violated his 14th and Fourth Amendment rights, constitutional rights, during his arrest. He is seeking punitive damages. There's no monetary amount. But in interviews, Mr. Brown and his attorney have said that his real point here is that he wants to bring about change in the police department and change within the department as to how they handle interactions, particularly interactions with young African-American men.
Have we heard anything? I know this was just filed this week. Have we heard anything from the police department or the city in response to the lawsuit?
We have not. The police department in the past not commented on pending litigation. When we did reach out on Tuesday for some sort of response or comment to see if they wanted to weigh in, the department indicated the police chief would be discussing this before different city boards on Thursday and would be available for questions after. So it's unclear if, he will be making specific responses to the lawsuit. As of yet, it doesn't appear that the city has filed any sort of response in federal court yet to the claims raised in the lawsuit.
Do we have any idea of the timing when this lawsuit will actually be taken up?
Well, as Mr. Brown's attorney, Mark Thompson, said, if these things follow how the city has handled past police misconduct lawsuits, it could be a process of up to 2 years before there's some sort of resolution. However, it is up to the city and how they respond. We will have a better idea probably in the coming weeks as to, you know, how the city is going to approach this.
Talking to Ashley Lutheran, public safety reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with the latest on the Sterling Brown case. The basketball players filed a lawsuit against the Milwaukee Police Department. Ashley, what are local officials saying, not so much about the lawsuit itself, but the incident, what it says about Milwaukee as a community and about the police department?
You know, I think from the very beginning, as, you know, the police department was preparing to at least show 30 minutes of body camera footage that they put out initially, there was a real effort. And you heard from city officials who said, you know, frankly, they were disturbed by what they saw. They don't think that interaction was handled appropriately. They believe the officers unnecessarily escalated this. And these are people, not just the police chief who's saying this, but the mayor, common council members. And then you also, you know, once the lawsuit was filed, there's really been a lot of discussion inside and outside of City Hall about specifically these Facebook posts and kind of what that says about the officers involved. You had the, you know, civilian chairman of the Fire and Police Commission just saying he was shocked by reading those Facebook posts, and that it does mean there's going to be, you know, just a longer road to restoring community trust and rebuilding police-community relations.
You also co-wrote a piece with somebody who covers the Milwaukee Bucks themselves about the team and the ownership response at the team. What kind of things are you hearing there?
So the Bucks, from the very beginning, have been very supportive about of Sterling Brown and the way he's conducted himself during this. My colleague Matt Velasquez, you know, interviewed the general manager John Horst on Tuesday, and he said, you know, we're beyond proud of Sterling. He pointed out that, you know, he believes what happened to Sterling was, quote, obviously unacceptable and shows us how far we have to go. But again, emphasizing his support and that it really hasn't been a question for the organization. They support Sterling Brown completely, 100%. He said.
So what are you watching for next in this story?
What I'm watching for next is, you know, if I'm waiting for some response back from the Milwaukee Police Department as an agency to confirm, yes, there is an ongoing internal affairs investigation, and to see if there's any particular information about what discipline could be handed down or what discipline is on the table. And I'm also very interested to hear how the department responds to the fact that they were on notice since May 25th. At least the chief was copied on a letter from Sterling Brown's attorney, Mark Thompson, in which he did reference these Facebook posts because he asked for that to be preserved as part of the evidence, as part of their open records request for any and all documentation related to this arrest.
Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ashley Lutheran is the public safety reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about the latest in the lawsuit against Milwaukee and its police department following the tasing and arrest of Milwaukee Bucks rookie Sterling Brown. Right now, milk prices have been at record lows for some years now, and for farmers, that's raising questions about the way we price milk. One alternative that's gotten some attention is the Canadian model of supply management. Mark Stevenson is a dairy policy analyst and the director of the UW Center for Dairy Profitability. He's written about issues with the American system for milk pricing. He joins us now in our studio. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, and happy to be here.
Well, let's talk about how we got here. You wrote in a piece for WisContext not too long ago that just a few years ago, dairy farmers had really high prices for milk. How do we get from there to here?
Well, those record high prices probably were the high prices of a generation, in my opinion. And when we get market prices like that, it's a market that's telling us we want more of your product. And so farmers have both the incentive and the wherewithal to produce more. And since we have roughly 40,000 dairy farmers in the country, they all receive that signal at the same time. They make decisions about producing milk, and sometimes we do overproduce.
And a tricky thing here has got to be timing, because if I'm a dairy farmer and the prices are high, it's not like I can turn a spigot and produce more starting tomorrow. Everybody has to make those decisions, and those decisions all kick in over a period of time after those prices may have gone down.
Well, they certainly do. I mean, there are a few things you can do in the short term to change milk production decisions. You can maybe keep a few more cows than you otherwise would have, or you can feed them a little bit harder to get more milk. But honestly, in the long term, the only thing to really do is to think about expanding your operation, maybe putting a few more cows on. That's a multi-year decision. That doesn't happen overnight.
Talk about the state of milk supply right now. Where are we?
You know, actually, we aren't that bad in terms of total milk production. We've been increasing somewhere around 1% per year. And that is not an unusual increase for us, and it keeps up with our domestic demand growth. One of the real problems that we've had is that we entered the world export markets in a fairly big way, maybe 12, 15 years ago. When that happened, we've now got customers overseas, and those are a little bit more erratic than our domestic customers are.
So it's a matter of supply is gradually going up, but demand is bouncing?
It fluctuates, and occasionally, you know, we have supply that will take surges or crashes. A few years ago, you might remember a big snowstorm in the Southwest. They named that storm Goliath, and there were some 30,000 cows that were killed overnight. And so that kind of thing can have a minor short-term impact on supplies.
Talk about dairy farms in Wisconsin over this last year or two. We keep hearing stories, a farm closing every day or more than a farm, farm and a half every day. What is the state of dairy farming in Wisconsin now?
You know, you mentioned, I think when we first started, that we're in record low dairy prices. And of course, they aren't actually record low. They are low relative to where we've been. But the real problem that we've had is the persistence of these low prices. And usually we've had a low that plunged deep and it was relatively short, and a year, year and a half later, we were back at more normal prices. This time we're entering our fourth year of low prices, and farms have just exhausted the kind of reserve money or short-term input costs that they actually normally keep on hand, and they're starting to borrow from equity. So it's difficult for dairy farms.
So why are prices staying that low for so long?
Part of it has been our exports. I mentioned earlier, we had been low on the volume of milk that we've been exporting here for a few years' time period, and that was in some ways due to our competitors overseas. The European Union produced a lot more milk and dairy products the last few years, and that's displaced some of the sales opportunities we would have had. So when those products stay here on shore in our domestic markets, they begin to build up stocks of storable dairy products like cheese and butter, milk powders. And when that happens, ultimately prices have to be pushed down. And that's what we've been seeing.
In the tariff and trade stories we've been hearing lately, Canada's been accused of tariffs, at least on some dairy products from the United States. How big a part of the story of milk prices in the U.S. Is that kind of issue? Tariffs, protectionism, that kind of thing?
You know, I may sound different than some of the other guests you could have on the show, but it's not been a huge impact at this point in time, but it could be. Canada has had high tariffs for a long period of time to protect a milk pricing system that's quite a bit different from our own. And they chose to change their milk pricing policy about a year ago or so to protect themselves from additional product that was starting to come in from the United States. And that's when we, the dairy industry, took offense at that.
Talking to Mark Stevenson, director of the UW Center for Dairy Profitability. Long-term low milk prices are hurting farmers in Wisconsin and around the country. Mark, we've heard people talk about that Canadian system both as kind of the enemy here, but also as maybe a model, some people are saying, for the unstable, the big fluctuations in prices. How does that work in Canada?
Well, in Canada, back in the mid-1960s, they were seeing persistently low prices and felt that they really needed to do something different. So they began to think about what could we do. And dairy farmers did get together and they made some decisions. And with the support of the government, we're able to put together a program that restricts the amount of milk that dairy producers are allowed to market each day. And that can grow over time or as they have need, but at any point in time, they're not allowed to sell any more into the market than what their quota is. And of course, to be able to protect a system like that from the outside, in other words, the U.S. would be happy to supply milk and dairy products to Canada, they have to have pretty steep tariffs to restrict that product from being able to come in.
So if I'm a dairy farmer in Canada, has that meant more stable prices for me?
Their prices have been both more stable and higher than U.S. prices. Canada is really kind of an outlier in the world where dairy products are produced in any kind of volume. Their system is a bit different than a lot of people's system is, but it has kept their milk prices higher and more stable.
If I'm a Canadian consumer, does this mean I'm paying more for milk, cheese, other dairy products?
It does. In general, consumer prices for those products are higher in Canada. I know you'll find some folks that would argue that they aren't, but in fact they are. When you look at the retail prices, they're maybe 25% higher than what our domestic prices are here.
Do you know what popular opinion is on this dairy program in Canada? I've heard there's at least some controversy about it up there.
Within Canada?
Within Canada.
Oh, sure. Within Canada, there is some controversy about it. You know, understand that at these relatively high prices, farms can be profitable. And so that, as I mentioned earlier, is a market signal telling you we want more of your product, but they can't produce and deliver more of their product. So that becomes a frustration. For those folks for whom it's been too large a frustration, we've had a few Canadian dairy farmers over the years that have relocated down into the U.S. simply because they wanted the ability to produce more milk.
Bringing things back to the United States now, are there changes, maybe short of doing something like Canada, that could lead to more stability and predictability for dairy farmers?
Oh, there are things that can be done. I mean, you could consider going all the way to a Canadian-style system. I think that that's going to be very divisive between farmers here in this state and across the country. So if it's divisive, I think it's going to be very hard to push something like that through Congress. But short of that, there are things that can be done as well. Really, what you need to do is to coordinate this supply chain a little bit more to let people know and understand what's going on and how do we maybe moderate our enthusiasm when we get really high prices for that. You can do that maybe by tempering some of those price peaks. In other words, not having the prices become as high as they were in a year like 2014. But in so doing, you probably forego some of the lows that you have after a time period like that.
Yeah, who puts their finger on the scale, though, and says we're going to moderate those high-end prices?
Well, we have price discovery that happens with federal milk marketing orders in most parts of the country, certainly here in the upper Midwest. And that's a place where this discovered price through a federal milk marketing order could be altered so that it didn't capture quite that much height and maybe would not, allow quite such a low either. And so in doing that, moderating this, you might have prices that were not as fluctuating and long persistent lows like we've seen right now to dairy farmers.
With the current price fluctuations and these long-term low prices, does this bias toward a larger dairy farm doing better? If I've got a larger operation, my per unit cost, I get an economy of scale, I'm better able to survive these low prices?
We have seen that. When you look at dairy farms, we find profitable dairy farms in all farm sizes. We also find unprofitable dairy farms in all farm sizes. And one of the critiques that I often hear is that people hear the words out of a mouth that says bigger is better. And we don't actually believe that. What we think is that better is better. If you're a better dairy cow handler, if you are a better manager of your labor force and people, if you're a better financial planner and manager, then you're a greater success. And with that, you have both, again, the incentive and the wherewithal to become a larger dairy farm. So to some extent, I think that larger dairy farms have been selected from the better farms.
If a policymaker came to you and said, Mark, what can we do to keep maybe some of these smaller farms in business in these rural communities that don't have a lot of employers, this might be a big driver of their local economy. What would you say to them?
I think there are several things that we could probably think about doing. And some of those become differential programs. So, in other words, we wouldn't want to provide the same stimulus to all of our dairy industry because some will react more strongly than others. In other words, it used to be easier. When we had a problem, the whole dairy industry had a problem. Today, when we have a problem, maybe only part of the dairy industry has a problem. So providing a solution for everybody is not necessarily a good thing. We would have to have this differential easing of prices, I guess, to some of our smaller farms.
Now, I know, I don't know if this is still in the new Farm Bill. There used to be those value-added grants that aimed at helping farmers diversify, maybe not rely on the swings of commodity prices. Is that something that's out there? Is it something that's an opportunity for dairy farmers to maybe, instead of just selling, you know, the milk, to sell cheese or butter or other value-added product?
Well, sure, it can be. And we do talk with producers all the time who are thinking about going into value added. But I'm cautious about that. I mean, one of the first things I do is to just throw buckets of cold water at somebody. And if there's still steam coming off afterward, then let's talk about it a little more. And the reason is value added is hard. I mean, you're taking on an entirely new enterprise now to produce the product and especially marketing the product. That's not something that farmers are used to doing.
Do you have any reason to believe that milk prices are going to find their way back up in the short run on their own?
Oh, I think this problem will correct itself, and I don't think that we ought to be necessarily jumping at a solution right now because today's prices are low and have been low for a period of time. The market will correct itself. But I do think it's very legitimate for us to think longer term and say, can we do something that keeps us from getting into these positions for a prolonged period of time? And I think the answer to that is yes, we have ideas.
We'll leave it there for now. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That's Mark Stevenson, Dairy Policy Analyst and Director of the UW Center for Dairy Profitability. He's with us to talk about issues with the American milk pricing system and other pricing models used by countries like Canada. We hear all the time that having children changes your life. Often that's implied to be a good thing. But for mothers in particular, having a kid may result in different treatment from employers during job interviews and in salary. Discrimination against working mothers may be more common than we realize. Catherine Goldstein is a journalist who focuses on women and work, a 2017 Nieman Fellow, and is currently developing a podcast about millennial working mothers. Her recent piece in the New York Times opinion section is The Open Secret of Anti-Mom Bias at Work. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Catherine, tell us some of the basics. First of all, what kind of discrimination do we see moms or soon-to-be moms encountering at work?
So this is actually what I would term an epidemic. Basically, there is so much bias against women in the workplace when they are going to become mothers or when they're mothers. It's often not even fully recognized by women, and it's certainly not recognized by employers. There's a number of laws that protect women from pregnancy discrimination and what's called family responsibilities discrimination. And we're seeing a number of court cases that have come up. And women actually win about 75% of the time that goes to litigation because employers are seemingly so clueless about their discriminatory behavior.
And to pin this down a little bit, this isn't about discrimination against parents at the workplace. Men do fine, or even in some cases their salaries go up when they become fathers?
Yes. So this is not the economic impact for women is truly astonishing. Fathers, actually, they've done some interesting studies where if you comparing candidates that have a female candidate, one has a subtle indication she is a mother, she's 37 percentage points less likely to be hired. And if she is made a job offer, it's a significantly lower salary. Whereas for men, if there's any indication that they're a parent, they're actually offered a 6% higher salary. So this has a huge, there's a bunch of sort of social and cultural things that go into feeling like men who are fathers deserve more and women who are mothers deserve less.
You have some anecdotes in that piece in the New York Times. You start off with one. You're talking to a woman. I think it's a conference about how to advance women in the workplace. And she tells a story about a former pregnant employee. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I opened the piece with an anecdote. I was having a meeting with someone who worked in the women's health space, and she just started sort of, she went on a tangent about how it was a small company and someone on her team got pregnant, and she felt she wasn't as focused on her job, and she was too focused on the pregnancy, so she had to let her go. And this woman is a mother herself, and I think that one really important part of this is that this is not just clueless, chauvinist men who don't have children who perpetrate these injustices. This bias is so deep that men perpetrated against women, women against other women, and mothers against other mothers. And so I think it's basically, if you are making a decision about whether someone should be hired or fired because they are pregnant, that is discrimination. And so it's amazing we're at a place where people are only just starting to really come to consciousness and realize that that is the case. And it's protected. And that's also not just my opinion. That's, that's the ruling of the EEOC. And there's, litigation that supports this.
Reading a number of the stories, it seems like the underlying thought is, OK, a mom or a pregnant woman who's soon to be a mom has this other priority in her life. She's not going to take work as seriously. Work is going to take a backseat. That's why we as employers are worried. What do we know about research on that, though?
Well, actually, the research finds that working mothers are actually more productive and efficient than other kinds of workers. So I'm sure plenty of your listeners know, if you want something done efficiently, give it to a busy working mom, because a lot of times those are the people who are focused. They're not spending their work days on Facebook and messing around. And maybe, they don't always have as many hours to devote in the office because they have caregiving responsibilities. But working mothers are the idea that they're a drag on businesses and a drag on society is sexist and wrong, and the data does not support that.
Talking to Catherine Goldstein, her piece in the New York Times opinion section is The Open Secret of Anti-Mom Bias at Work. Can you share another story or two? You talked to women in kind of high-powered jobs and in finance and things like that. Talk about what sort of roadblocks they ran into.
Well, after my piece came out a couple weeks later, another New York Times story came out that I highly recommend that really goes into a lot of discrimination that mothers have faced in the workplace in a bunch of different kinds of careers. And so things that I've read about and I've heard and I've researched include, basically as soon as someone finds out that they're pregnant, not being given a promised promotion or sort of being sort of seen as not no longer committed or openly being questioned whether or not they're coming back to work. And those sorts of things are self-fulfilling prophecies. If you are unsupportive of pregnant women and make a hostile work environment towards them, maybe they're not as likely to want to come back and work for you. And I think another really important part of this is the idea of benevolent discrimination. And this happens in workplaces a lot, where someone thinks they're doing a working mom a favor by not giving her that extra assignment or not offering to, let her attend a conference because she wouldn't want to be away from her kids. Making those decisions for women and assuming that they don't want to work or that they are not committed is actually a form of discrimination. You shouldn't take someone's family responsibilities in deciding who should be promoted or who can handle certain kinds of jobs.
And you write about this. You use the phrase open secret. Why do you call it that?
It's interesting because I think it's an open secret because the workplace has made a lot of strides in terms of people understanding certain kinds of behavior are not acceptable. Obviously, the Me Too movement has shown a lot of light on sexual harassment in the workplace. And I think a lot of there'd be generally a very large consensus that that is wrong and that people shouldn't do that. But with bias against mothers, there's an openness to it because people don't really think it's wrong. A lot of people don't think it's wrong. And a lot of times women don't recognize what's happening to them as discrimination. So again, that's why a supposed feminist business leader could say such openly discriminatory things to a feminist journalist and not think twice about it. So I think that a lot of times things like, comments like, we're going to have to do layoffs. She just had a baby. She'd probably rather be home with her kid anyway. That's discrimination. And people will say things like that without thinking twice about it in a ways that they won't always talk about other kinds of discriminatory behavior in groups.
When you wrote this piece and put it out there, did you hear from mothers or other readers saying, yeah, this is going on where I work?
the response I got to this piece is unlike any response I've ever gotten to anything that I have done in over 10 years as a journalist. I got hundreds of emails, a lot of women who really, who told me they cried when they read the piece, which was, it's not a sentimental op-ed, but they really connected to it because they felt like they were alone and that they were going through these experiences by themselves, and they felt so frustrated by what had happened to them, and they weren't sure what to do, and they felt like they wanted, I got a lot of emails of people wanting to tell me their stories and just know that someone was listening. So, it definitely hit a nerve, and the response I got really showed me that almost every working mother has a story, and whether or not for some women it completely derailed their careers and their lives, and other women is something that they've had to struggle through or have remained silent about. But it only further showed to me what a completely widespread epidemic this is.
We're talking to Catherine Goldstein, journalist who focuses on women and work. We're talking about her recent piece in the New York Times opinion section. It's called The Open Secret of Anti-Mom Bias at Work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Are you a mother who's been treated, you think, differently at your job, maybe during your pregnancy or now that you have kids? Have you encountered difficulties getting a job, getting fired from a job, being paid less than your peers? How does your worksite handle these issues if you're an employer? Do you try to be careful to avoid this kind of discrimination? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're continuing the conversation about how pregnant women and mothers are treated differently in the workplace, worse in many cases, our guest says. Catherine Goldstein is with us, a journalist. Her recent piece in the New York Times opinion section is titled The Open Secret of Anti-Mom Bias at Work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this where you work? Are you a mom in the workplace? Have you been treated differently? Has your pay not gone up? Have your responsibilities been changed, do you think, because you're a mom? If you're an employer, how do you try to deal with these issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. To your calls now, Lori is with us in Madison. Lori, hi.
I also wanted to add that there's a lot of discrimination against people that are retired, women that are retired, that are quasi-senior citizens. I retired about 3 years ago, and I applied for some part-time positions in which I was totally qualified for. I was probably overqualified for. And I was really close. I was always in the final four, the last of the candidates. But I wasn't hired for these positions. They hired much younger people with far less experience than I.
Lori, thanks for the call. Not exactly about moms at the workplace, but do you think there's maybe some overlap or common themes there, Catherine?
I definitely think ageism is a big problem in the workplace, and I think this sort of touches on some larger themes, which I think a lot of times people feel like maybe mothers are somehow getting, if they're allowed to go do their daycare pickup, they're getting somehow special treatment. And I think this really speaks to the idea that workplaces need to actually be much more humane to everyone and sort of recognize everyone as different and see diverse workforces and having a lot of different kinds of people in your work environment as positive, bringing creative ideas and different kinds of thinking. And that's also having older workers as part of that as well.
Lori, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Emily in Madison. Emily, hi.
Hi, I'm a high school teacher, and I just listening to the show, I just want to thank you for sharing this and bringing attention to this. But I had two experiences I wanted to share. The first was as a high school teacher, when I was pregnant, I would hear things said behind my back that some students would repeat to me that boys would say, pregnant women shouldn't be working. So that's kind of an interesting thing that I've experienced. And then also, I recently interviewed for a part-time position and mentioned my young children when I was in the interview. And when I got the call that I wasn't going to be hired, they said, you wouldn't want this position anyway. That was kind of how it was phrased to me, which I think now is code for, you know, the fact that they hired someone who was 23 and without a family. So I just wanted to thank you and maybe ask if you've also talked about teachers' experiences.
Emily, thanks for that call. You wouldn't want this job anyway. That fits into some of what you were talking about earlier, Catherine.
Yeah, the idea we're doing you a favor by discriminating against you is very much speaks to that idea of this openness about this kind of discrimination. I mean, it can be subtle and open at the same time. I've heard from women of all different professions, and actually one sad thing that I've heard is definitely people in professions that you think would be more accommodating. There's obviously a lot of women who work in teaching. I've read some horrifying stories of actual like gynecologist doctors who've been treated really badly, who are working in women's health. Like, unfortunately, just because an environment has a lot of women or is somehow supposedly helping women. Also, there's really bad stories from nonprofits that supposedly have, you know, important social missions of empowerment. So no workplace is immune from this. And just because a lot of women work there, or maybe even that there's some mothers there, doesn't mean that these problems don't exist. And it's definitely real in the teaching field.
Thanks a lot for that call and for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Talking to Catherine Goldstein, her recent piece in the New York Times, The Open Secret of Anti-Mom Bias at Work. You can join in if you have an experience of this or a question. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. On Facebook, we heard from Leanne, who says, I've received discrimination for not having kids in the form of an expectation that my schedule is flexible, that I should be able to switch shifts whenever and cover shifts on my days off as needed. Just because I don't have a kid doesn't mean I don't have a life. And we hear complaints like that. We've seen articles written about that in the past, Catherine. Non-parents complaining that they are expected to pick up some slack.
Right. Well, so what that listener is experiencing isn't discrimination, but it is a poorly run workplace. Discrimination is actually, you know, not allowing people to have opportunities, not paying them as much, firing them for a set amount of reasons. That's not what that person is experiencing. I, again, really think workplaces... A workplace that says moms get special treatment and you have to pick up the slack, or you know, because you don't have kids, you don't have a life, that isn't fair to those people. But at the same time, and creating a workplace that supports everyone, and whether it's, you know, they have hobbies or pets or they have aging parents, you have to be able to support people at all stages of their life. And it's not about just giving special treatment. But I think this animosity towards women who have children that they're somehow getting off easy has undertones of sexism to it, even from other women. And I think that a lot of times that's because of these competitive and poorly run workplaces that don't really value their employees.
Want to go to another caller now. We have Tori on the line in La Crosse. Tori, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I had a similar experience in a job interview. I was asked how I maintain being a good mom, wife, and employee, and there was, you know, I said it's all a balance, but I think that's the best way to that anyone manages all everything in life. But I was told that being an employee should be the first thing, my number one priority, and I didn't get the job. So,
Tori, thanks a lot. I haven't applied for a lot of jobs since I became a dad. I've never been asked in those few interviews how I would balance being a dad, a husband, and an employee. Is that something that moms get more?
So much more. I think it would be almost unheard of for a dad's credentials. Like, do you think you could take on this responsibility while also being a father? It's something that basically would never happen in a job interview. It also shouldn't happen in job interviews with women. That's clearly discriminatory. And, you know, employers are very short-sighted. If they want people who have no other responsibilities, they're going to limit their job pool, and they're also going to limit all sorts of talent and all sorts of ideas. Women and mothers bring a new and different and important perspective to so many industries. And so to say we only want people who've never had those experiences working for us, but so we can just work them to the bone and be sure they're never going to leave their desk before 9 p.m., you're not going to have a good workforce. And so, but again, that kind of question in a job interview, I'm not a lawyer. I would think it would be on the legal line, but and also would be almost unheard of for a dad to get that kind of question.
Tori, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Lisa in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a scientist and a mother, and I just want to say I'm thrilled anytime this topic comes up. I think it's so, so important. Myself, I've just left work, and I'm rushing home to meet my nanny, so I understand the struggle. And two things I wanted to say that I think kind of echo some of the comments that have been made is that first, as I work my way up the professional ladder, I've noticed that some of the most challenging relationships I've had to negotiate have been with senior women who don't have kids. And so I think that, you know, we need to understand that a lot of the sexism, like you said earlier, does come from other women to women. And I think that that's something that's not often discussed, that it's assumed that maybe it's just coming only from men to women. And then second, I think that one of the biggest things that we can do as women is make sure that we're getting men more involved in family life. I think it's really important for things like, you know, leaving early to attend a school performance or doctor's visits or sick days. I mean, I think that if men were taking up more of that responsibility, you know, these types of issues would be able to be seen more as parent issues than as women issues. And when they're seen as something that affects men, I think that's when we're going to be able to really get more action taken on some of these issues. Thank you.
Lisa, thanks. Catherine, what do you think?
Totally agree. Men are often in positions of leadership and authority, and setting a tone for an organization is so important, whether it's being transparent that, hey, I'm working from home because I'm taking care of my sick toddler, or, you know, I'm going to a soccer game. That setting those examples and being transparent is really important. Another really important part of this is making sure dads get real family leave from their companies and that they take it. That sets a really important precedent at home, and it also sets it reduces bias against mothers in the workplace, because if you have candidates, a man and a woman, who are equally likely to be taking family leave, you're less likely, women are less likely to be discriminated against in hiring. So I think men are an important part of this fight. And if you are a man who cares about this and you have the opportunity to take paid family leave, take as much of paid family leave as you possibly can.
Catherine, just a few moments left. You say this is an open secret. Do you see people starting to talk about it more?
I do. I'm very optimistic that we're going to hear more and more from women who are sharing their stories. And a lot of times thinking back on this for the first time and think about, oh, maybe I felt like it was a choice that I left that job, but really I was being, you know, demoted and I had a really negative experience. And maybe that wasn't really a choice. And I think women are looking back on their professional lives and looking forward to their professional lives with new eyes. And I truly believe that this is the next wave of the Me Too movement.
Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Catherine Goldstein is a journalist who focuses on women and work. She's currently developing a podcast about millennial working mothers. She joined us to talk about her recent piece in the New York Times opinion section. It's called The Open Secret of Anti-Mom Bias at Work. Still time for you to share your stories over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's National Selfie Day, according to someone, and people are taking to the internet to share their self-images slightly more than usual, or to complain about selfies slightly more than usual. I have seen pictures from some of our public television colleagues, including Kermit the Frog and Elmo, plus a lot of humans have joined in, celebrities and otherwise. The most fun, probably astronaut Buzz Aldrin, who reminded the world today that he took the first space selfie. He took the image while in orbit on the Gemini 12 mission back in 1966. In the much retweeted picture today, you can see his face in shadow in his astronaut helmet, of course, with the curve of the Earth looming in the background. Aldrin tweeted, "That was one expensive selfie stick." And there's more evidence that we were taking pictures of ourselves long before today's era of the smartphone. The Library of Congress catalog includes a picture from 1839, believed to be the first selfie and the first American portrait photo. The daguerreotype photo method, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but we'll go with it. It was announced in August of 1839. In October of that year, Robert Cornelius of Philadelphia captured a head and shoulders image of himself using that process. The exposure time apparently would have been about 3 to 15 minutes to capture his image, which I think would kind of kill that, like, hey, we're at a restaurant, let's do a quick daguerreotype and post it online. To celebrate, I will not be posting selfies of myself. I don't need that. Nobody needs that. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.